Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true? They don't think Christianity's true. They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've just returned from five campus events over the past couple of weeks. And as always, these campus events are quite interesting during the Q&A. And I got some really interesting questions that I want to talk about today. They're some of the questions, obviously, you get over and over again. But there's a couple in here that are unique, mostly from unbelievers, from atheists, and from agnostics. And of course, whenever you call something, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. Whenever you call an event, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, particularly on a college campus, you're going to get everybody from atheist to Christian showing up and everyone in between. And so the Q&A period is always interesting. It's always intriguing because you get a lot of different perspectives and you get a lot of different challenges to the Christian faith. And for those of you that that know about our app, which now is just past a year old, over 40,000 downloads, so people find it helpful, particularly the quick answer section in the app, you know that in the quick answer section, there are four E's. We call these the four E's because most of the objections that you get for about Christianity come in one of these four categories that begin with the letter E. You get questions on evil. If God, why evil? You get questions on evolution, and we're going to go over one of those questions we had just the other night at Wright State University. We had a question on evolution. You get questions on ethics, like why did God kill the Canaanites, those kind of questions. Or maybe you get a question on current-day ethics, like homosexuality. And you get questions on eternity. Will God send me to hell just because I don't believe in Jesus? Or what about those that have never heard? Or why would God create somebody who he knew would go to hell? Those kinds of questions. And it's interesting, those questions always have a moral component behind them. In other words, there's a moral standard being assumed behind the question. And somehow, if Christianity is true, God is seen as immoral. So you always have to challenge the premise of the question or the assumption under the question. And most of the questions we're going to talk about today came in one of those four categories, although there's a little bit of nuance on some of the questions. Let's go to, I was at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, Illinois, just a couple of weeks ago, did a couple of sessions there, did both parts of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Part one, of course, covers does truth exist, does God exist? Part two covers are miracles possible and is the New Testament true or historically reliable and therefore you can make a case the entire Bible is true. In fact, those are the four questions, as you know, to show that Christianity is true. Does truth exist? Does God exist? Are miracles possible and is the New Testament historically reliable? If you answer yes to those four questions, you can show beyond a reasonable doubt that Christianity is true. Well, at Southern Illinois University had several good questions. One question came from an atheist. The gentleman stood up. I think his name was David. I don't have all the names remembered right now, but all the questioners were very respectful. We had some good dialogues. And David seemed to be an open-minded atheist. He stood up and he said, look, first thing he says, look, I'm an atheist. And now, I don't know, I won't have this conversation down verbatim. I haven't remembered it, so give me some grace here. I'm kind of giving you the gist of what he said and what I said. But basically, he said, you don't need God for morality. He said, I just think that people ought to treat one another fairly. Now, if someone ever said that to you, if they said, treat one another fairly, what should your question be? Remember what we're trying to do here. If when we're having a conversation with somebody, if they say something that you think is problematic or you think is wrong, it is not your job to refute what they say. It is their job to support what they say. So what question should you ask somebody if they say, I think everybody ought to treat everyone fairly? Well, I think the question you ought to ask is, what do you mean by fairly? What do you mean by fair? And so I asked him that question, and he said, well, equal. I said, what do you mean by equal, and why equal? Who said equal? And so we went back and forth a little bit. And he actually said, look, I don't think communism's a bad thing. I said, what do you mean by bad? And if you keep asking questions long enough, somebody's going to have to get to some sort of standard. Because in order to say something is bad, you have to assume that something is good. Because if something is not good, it means you're implying that something really is good. Well, what is the standard of good that allows you to judge something as bad? So you have to always ask the question, what do you mean by that? This goes back to Greg Kokel's book, as you know, his book Tactics. We've talked about it several times on this program. And I think that's an excellent question. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by bad, or what do you mean by good? And so we went back and forth a little bit on this. And I eventually said, well, here's the problem. If there is no God, if there is no standard beyond humanity, then everything is reduced to opinion. It's just your opinion against somebody else's opinion. And I said, look, I could agree with you that we ought to treat everyone fairly. Of course, that begs the question as to what do you mean by fair? But what if I said, what if you say, look, we ought to treat everybody fairly, and Hitler or somebody comes along and says, well, I want to treat everybody my own way, and that includes me killing you to take your resources to enrich me. I said, if there is no God, why would that be wrong? And this atheist very gracefully said, you know, that's an excellent point. He had never even thought about it. So he was open-minded. And so I said to him, I said, David, look, appreciate your question. If I give you a book, would you read it? And he said, oh, yeah, I'd read it. So I gave him a book. I gave him, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. And hopefully the people there at organize the event will follow up with him. He was very open-minded. That's very nice to see somebody who stands up in front of a group of a couple hundred people and tries to take a position and realizes that maybe the position that he was holding can't be defended. And so he said, you know, you have a good point. That's very refreshing to see. I don't see that very often. So kudos to David. The next questioner, one of the next questioners, stood up and he said, hi, my name's Dominic. I said, hi, Dominic. And he said, you know, I just gone through the evidence that the Bible was true, that the New Testament was true, and it was in part two of the seminar, and I made the case that I thought the New Testament documents were reliable, and therefore you could trust what they say, and if you can trust what they say, basically Christianity is true. And he said, you're just saying that because somebody told you it's true. How do you know it's true? And I said, well, there's evidence, Dominic. We went just through all the evidence. We went through the fact that there's early testimony, there's eyewitness testimony, there's embarrassing testimony, there's excruciating testimony, there's extra-biblical testimony, there's even expected testimony from Old Testament prophecies that tells us that we ought to expect a Messiah like Jesus to come along. It's predicted. I mean, there's evidence there. There's archaeological evidence that we can bring to bear on some of the events to show that these are real historical events. And he said, well, look, my name's actually not Dominic. My name's Tommy. And the only reason you believed it was Dominic is because I told you it was Dominic. But it's really Tommy. I said, okay, Tommy, Dominic. That's true. But he just went on to say, well, you're just saying it's true because somebody told you. I said, yes, I am believing it because somebody told me. But I can verify what somebody told me by looking at other evidence, by looking at external evidence, internal evidence, by looking at archaeology, by looking at evidence that can confirm or deny what these individuals have said. And we went back and forth a little bit, and I said, he said, well, you're just believing this because somebody told you. I said, no, I've got evidence for it. I said, do you believe George Washington existed? And he said, yes. And I said, why? He said, because somebody told me. He literally, he said that. And of course, everybody laughed. And it was just an interesting exchange. In fact, most of what we know on authority. We know what people have said, and we can check it out. And we're going to check out some more questions right after the break. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. Our website, crossexamined.org, with a D on the end of it. See you in 2 minutes. If you're low on the FM dial looking for NPR, go no further. We're actually going to tell you the truth here. That's our intent anyway. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. We're talking about questions that are common questions that one gets when one does, and I don't have enough faith to be an atheist seminar on a college campus. I've just done five of these seminars in the past couple of weeks, and so we've had some excellent exchanges with atheists and agnostics and some Christians, of course, at these events, and the questions they bring up are quite good, and they're not actually totally unique. As I mentioned at the top of the show, questions tend to come in one of four categories, the four E's. They come in evil, evolution, ethics, and eternity. And those four E's and some of these questions we get in those categories can be found on our app, the Cross-Examined app, which is free, by the way. You can get it at our website. If you go to crossexamined.org, click on media, you'll see the app there. It works on all platforms, even the new iPhone, if the new iPhone works at all. I'm hearing that you get the new iPhone, you download the new iOS, and you don't have a phone anymore. You have an iPad because it can't call. Anyway, so some of these questions are actually, there's been some funny exchanges. I just mentioned before the break, this Dominic kid, whose real name was Tommy, so I called him Tommy Dominic, said that he couldn't believe the New Testament because it was just somebody saying that it was true. And I said, well, there's evidence that what they said was true really happened. External evidence, archaeological evidence, internal evidence. You know, you can bring all sorts of evidence to bear on this, and that's what I had done. And then I asked him, well, do you believe George Washington is actually existed? And he said, yes. And I said, why? He said, because somebody told me. I mean, he walked right into it. I don't know why he said it that way, but it was exactly the reason he was saying that I shouldn't believe what the New Testament says, because somebody told me. Well, you can check out the evidence and see if George Washington actually existed, if Jesus Christ actually existed, if what they did or what was said of them actually occurred. And, you know, it's interesting. These Christians, or I should say these atheists who come to these events, and not just they come to these events, but atheists in general, think it's just the Christian that has to have all sorts of faith, so to speak, to try and believe what they believe. Look, every worldview, I don't care what it is, whether it's Christianity, whether it's Islam, whether it's Buddhism, whether it's Hinduism, whether it's atheism, whether it's agnosticism, whatever, takes some sort of faith in the sense that you can't know everything or be assured of everything your worldview purports to promote. You have to take some on what we call faith. Now, the biblical definition of faith, as you know, if you've listened to this program, is not belief without evidence. It's trust in the object of the evidence that you have. In other words, if you have evidence that Jesus is God and that Christianity is true, then you trust in Jesus because of that evidence. Even if there may be some areas you're not quite sure actually are true or have occurred, even if you can't verify it, in other words, with external evidence. Every worldview does that. You say, well, reason does. No, even reason, even if you're just a rationalist, you have to depend on faith. Why? And I'm using faith in the common sense of the term. Again, not the biblical sense of the term. The biblical sense of the term, the actual word is trust. After you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Jesus is the Savior, then trust in him. That's what faith means. But in today's culture, faith means, well, you don't have any evidence or you have a lack of evidence. Well, let's just use that definition for a minute. Even somebody who's a rationalist has to have faith that reason works. Why? Because you can't prove reason by reason. That would be circular. To try and give reasons why you ought to believe in reason would be to use reason, which is exactly what you're trying to prove. So you have to have faith that reason works. And, of course, that's just a starting point. In fact, our starting point, and I'll get to it, let me just save it till the next question. In fact, let's just go into the next question. The next question that I got was from a guy by the name of Bob. He was actually an older gentleman, very nice gentleman. He got up there, he said, hey, I'm 74 years old. And he said, that presentation you just gave was just great. But, you know, and I'm an agnostic. I was in this room just a couple of weeks ago, and an atheist by the name of Richard Carrier was here. And he went through the David Hume argument that you went through. You went through the argument that Hume put forth against miracles, and you said the argument Hume put forth was faulty, and it is. It's a faulty argument. You Hume's argument against miracles doesn't work. He said, but Richard Carrier was in here, and he said Hume's argument against miracles was good, and he was persuasive too. And so, you know, I'm an agnostic. You really can't know anything for sure. And I said, well, how do you know that for sure? And we went back and forth a little bit. He said, you know, you and Richard Carrier have different epistemologies. What's an epistemology? Or epistemology is how you know something. And I said, well, my epistemology is that you start with the fundamental laws of logic, the self-evident principles of reason. You just take those on faith. You assume they work. And then you take data from your senses, and then you draw conclusions about the world and about reality by using these laws of logic and by using the data you get from your senses to draw some conclusions about the world. And you can arrive at a worldview that way. And the worldview that makes the most sense is Christianity. And he said, well, Richard Carrier had a different epistemology. I said, I know he does, but I don't know how he can arrive at any rational conclusion with his worldview, which is materialism. As far as I know, maybe Carrier's not a materialist, but I assume he is. He's a prominent atheist. If he's a materialist, I said, how can he know anything? Because if everything in his mind is just a product of natural forces, if he's just a moist robot, so to speak, if materialism's true, if we're just molecules in motion, why should he believe anything he thinks? And Bob said, well, I don't know. I don't know how Richard Carrier would come to that conclusion. And but then he went on to reiterate, this Bob gentleman, he went on to reiterate that you can't really know anything. And I said, Bob, no, I think you can know things. In fact, you know that you don't know. That's a conclusion that you're drawing that you think is reasonable. And I said, I think what you do is you take the laws of logic, you take your sense data, and you arrive at rational conclusions. And he said, well, I just don't think you can do that. And I said, well, how do you know what you believe is true? And he said, I don't. And everybody just laughed. He laughed. I laughed. Everybody laughed. And I said, Bob, at least you're honest. Bob, if I give you a book, would you read it? And he said, of course I would. So, Bob, see me after the seminar. I'll give you a book. He was just a delightful guy. But he went into a self-defeating position. He had a self-defeating position. To say that you can't know anything is to know that you can't know anything, which means that you could know something. You know, why end there? Why can you know that you can't know anything? Because you're knowing something then. If you can know something, then maybe you can know other things as well. Of course you can. I mean, if you want to be reasonable, you want to be rational about it, of course you can know some things. Now, is it true that you may not be able to know everything completely? Of course. Of course. In fact, here's a distinction that you need to make when people say, well, you know, God is infinite and you couldn't really know him and you know, we're finite. You could agree with all that. You could say, look, but there's a difference between knowing everything about something and knowing something about something. You can know something about God without knowing everything about God. You can apprehend God even if you can't completely comprehend God. I mean, you can stand in front of an ocean and apprehend there's an ocean in front of you, even if you can't completely comprehend everything in that ocean because you're limited. You don't have the amount of knowledge you need. But you know there's an ocean in front of you. The same thing is true of God. You can't completely comprehend an infinite being, but you can apprehend an infinite being. You can know something about him. So complete agnosticism is self-defeating. Then on the other side of the room, there was a gentleman by the name of Levi. I don't know why I remember these names, but I interact with people enough, so I ask them their name, and then we go back and forth. And he went on to say, there is no objective truth. All truth is subjective. Well, what question would you ask somebody who said there is no objective truth? And apparently, I asked him, I said, were you in the session yesterday? Because in the session yesterday, I covered the first question, does truth exist? And of course, as you know, if someone were to ever say there is no truth, you should ask that person a question. In fact, it's in the lead into our show. You should ask them, is that true? Is it true that there's no such thing as truth? Or is it objectively true there are no objective truths? So I asked him. I said, you say there's no objective truth. Is that objectively true? He said, no. Well, of course, then why should I believe it? If it's just in you, if it's just in you, the subject, in other words, there's no external referent. It's just your subjective opinion. Then why should I believe it? Why should anyone believe it? You see, relativism is self-defeating. You know, I very rarely have people on a college campus, very rarely have them trying to say that relativism is true. In fact, there was another atheist just the other night at Wright State who was reading the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and he agreed. He said, oh, yeah, all that stuff you have in the first couple chapters about relativism being false, I agree with 100%. You know, at least he's on his way to the truth. You know, he said, you can't be a relativist. That's just self-defeating. It's nonsense. And this guy was trying to be a relativist. So I just asked him, you know, is that a subjective truth? And you could see he was getting a little bit uncomfortable. We were having a kind conversation. I try to be very kind in these exchanges. But he didn't want the conversation to go on. He put on his backpack, and he was, like, trying to walk out the door. I said, it's Friday night. You got class Friday night? Where are you going? You know. So I said, let's continue this conversation. And so we did a little bit, and then we moved on to another person. But for somebody to say there is no objective truth, that all truth is subjective, is to defeat himself. And he went into actually, there were some other atheists at the event down at Southern Mississippi University last week. And Southern Mississippi University is a pretty campus and a very beautiful theater they have down there. I think it's called the Bennett Theater we were in. It was kind of like a little Carnegie Hall, a balcony and everything, and very, very very exquisitely decorated and designed inside. I think it was built in 1929. So we had a nice session in there, and we had several atheists asking questions there. And right after the break, I'm going to tell you exactly how it went, because it was quite interesting. Even spent an hour afterwards having a conversation with them. And oh, by the way, October 9th here in Charlotte, David Limbaugh, brother of Rush Limbaugh, and author of the new book, Jesus on Trial, will be at our donor banquet along with cold case homicide detective Jay Warner Wallace. If you'd like to attend, they're going to sign free copies of their books there. You need to go to crossexamined.org and click on events, and you'll see it. I hope you can join us. It's going to be a fabulous evening, October 9th, Thursday night. I'll tell you more in a minute. Welcome back to crossexamined.org. Well, it's Cross Examined with Frank Turek, and our website's crossexamined.org. We're on the AFR Talk Radio Network. And as I mentioned before the break, that we're having a donor banquet here in Charlotte. I don't really talk much about donations here, but this is listener-supported radio, and in order for this radio show to go on, we have to do it via donations. And our TV show and all of the events that we do on college campuses, you know, we don't charge students a dime on a college campus to attend any of our events. And so we have to raise money in order to do this. And as I was mentioning, what we're doing today is we're going through some of the questions I've gotten over the past couple of weeks at the five college events that I've presided over in these colleges, these five I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist events. And I'll get back to those questions in a minute. But I wanted to point out that our donor banquet is on October 9th here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And all the details are on our website. If you want to attend, just go to the website and click on events, and you'll see donor banquet there. It's also the first banner on our homepage, crossexamined.org. Limbaugh and Wallace will be there. I'll be there as well, of course, Ted Wright, our entire team. And right after that, the next 2 days here in Charlotte is the world's best apologetics conference, the Southern Evangelical Seminary Apologetics Conference. It is the 21st annual. It's going to be held at Calvary Church, which is just a beautiful church, a big church here in Charlotte, can hold about 5,500 people. And you've got some great speakers coming to that. You've got Hugh Ross, you've got Michael Behe, Norm Geisler, Josh McDowell, you've got Sean McDowell, Gary Habermas, of course, Jay Warner Wallace and David Limbaugh will be there. I'll be speaking as well. There'll be a number of opportunities you'll have to see some varied topics in apologetics. You'll have quite a selection to choose from. So come in for the banquet on Thursday, October 9th. The banquet and the silent auction begins at 6 p.m. And then that goes that night. And then the apologetics conference is all day Friday, all day Saturday. And so it's apologetics weekend here in just 2 weeks here in Charlotte, North Carolina. So I hope you can attend. Hope to see you there. Let me go back to some of these questions that were brought up at these college events. And these atheists at Southern Mississippi University were discussing with me I had gone through the first two questions, and I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. Does truth exist? Does God exist? And each of them got up there and began to talk about how materialism is true. Now, just before the break, I went through the fact that if materialism is true, there's no way we could know it, because if we're just molecules in motion, what do we know? Right? I mean, we can't know anything if we're just molecular machines. I mean, we can know something, but we have no warrant to think that it's true. That's the problem. And so we went back and forth on this with these atheists. And after the event was over, they wanted to go somewhere to get something to eat, like five of them. So I said, hey, why don't you just come back to the hotel and we'll sit and talk. So we went back to the hotel, five of these atheists and myself, and we just sat down for about an hour and a half. Now, keep in mind, the event started at 7 p.m. We walked out of the Bennett Auditorium at about 10 p.m., a little after 10. Then we went back to the hotel, and I interacted with these atheists till probably about 11:30, so I was pretty worn out. But the problem that these atheists have is that they don't seem to understand that if they are materialists, then they shouldn't know anything. They shouldn't be able to defend knowing anything. They can know things, but there's no way to know why it's true. And so I pointed this out in many different ways to them. And one of the ways that you can point this out, in addition to what I've just said, that you couldn't know anything, is to point out that the mind and the brain can't be the same for several reasons. In other words, you don't just make a negative case against the fact that you wouldn't be able to know anything because you're just molecules in motion. You can give positive evidence that the mind and the brain are not the same. And so that's what I did. I talked about the fact that the mind and the brain can't be the same for a number of reasons. And these reasons, by the way, are going to be in a new book that I've just finished. It's going to be actually coming out, I think, January 1st, if I'm not mistaken. The new book is called Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. And I'm privileged to have Robbie Zacharias write the foreword for this. So it's going to be coming out, as I say, just after Christmas, first of the year or so. And some of what I say in this book, I said to these young atheists at the hotel afterwards. One of the positive reasons we know that the mind and the brain can't be the same is because you and your thoughts often stay the same even though your brain changes. What do I mean by that? Well, scientists understand that you are not the same person you were when you started to listen to this program today, because your molecules are continually in flux. Many die, new ones are created. Materially, you're not the same person you were just 10 seconds ago, actually. Now, there's different estimates. Some say the molecules in your body change over every 7 years. Some say every 15 years, whatever it is. Let's just take the conservative estimate. Every 15 years, you are a completely new person molecularly. Well, why do you remember anything longer than 15 years ago? If you're 20 years old, if you're 30 years old, 40 years old, can you remember anything previous or older than 15 years ago? Of course you can. Why? Because your mind and your brain are not the same. there's a correlation between your mind and your brain, but it's not the same brain. You don't have the same brain you had 15 years ago, yet you can have thoughts that predate 15 years ago. Secondly, if you think about this, your thoughts are immaterial while your brain is material. Think right now about a 2-ton pink elephant. Now, if neuroscientists cracked open your skull right now, would they find a 2-ton pink elephant in there? If so, I'd have just killed you by saying that, right? Because you can't not think of a 2-ton pink elephant when I say that. You see, no matter how much scientists analyze the physical makeup of your brain, they will never find a 2-ton pink elephant in there or anything else you're thinking about. That's because your thoughts are immaterial. They are not parts of your material brain. Again, there's a correlation between your thoughts and your brain, or your brain and your thoughts, but your brain and your thoughts are two different things. A 2-ton pink elephant is not in your brain right now when you're thinking about it. There are several other reasons as well. In fact, there's another reason that many people know about but haven't really put this two and two together, and that is the placebo effect. In other words, your mind can change your brain. Think about this. In addition to your brain affecting your mind, there's good evidence that your immaterial mind affects your material brain. In other words, thoughts can change brain chemistry. They've done so much research on the placebo effect that they've realized that if you have certain thoughts, you can actually heal yourself to a certain extent, or your thoughts can change your brain chemistry. And, of course, this makes no sense if materialism's true. That's why there was a materialist-leaning magazine called The New Scientist magazine a number of years ago. They listed 13 things that don't make sense, and the number one thing that doesn't make sense was the placebo effect. Well, the reason it doesn't make sense is because they're assuming materialism's true. Doesn't make sense. Well, the reason it doesn't make sense on a materialistic viewpoint is because you don't have a mind. You just have a brain. So how do thoughts change your brain? Well, if thoughts do change your brain, then materialism's false. And it is false. Now, just how do the mind and the brain interact? There's many different theories about how they do that. That's a so-called mind-body problem. But the point is that there is some sort of dualism going on here. That yes, you have a brain, and it interacts with your mind. And the mind and the brain are not the same. There's a correlation, but they're not identical. And that's why those are positive reasons why materialism can't be true. The negative reason, of course, is that if materialism were true, there'd be no way to know why it's true. Because every thought you have is just the product of a previous natural cause over which you have no control. And they eventually got this as I was talking to them at the hotel. They finally realized, wow, this whole thing is self-defeating. Yes, it is self-defeating. And if it's self-defeating, then materialism, if it's true, there's no way to know it. And quite obviously, I mean, someone asks you a question. Here's another reason. You know, someone asks you a question. Someone says, hey, where were you born? And you go, well, I was born in Neptune, New Jersey. That's where I was born. How do I know that? Well, my mom told me, and so I remember it. That's where I was born. And when you ask that question, how do I specifically respond with that answer? Because I have a mind that can reason. I mean, are we to believe that when you ask me a specific question, that somehow the molecules in my brain form in such a way so that I provide you the right and true answer? Well, that takes more faith to believe than just to assume somebody has a mind. Just to believe that we have souls, just to believe that we are human beings that can make choices and reason to conclusions. I mean, materialists believe in magic. That I ask you a question like that and you give me the right answer based on magic, basically. Because, again, if your mind and your brain are the same, then just these molecules are somehow forming to cause you to give the right answer. That just seems absurd. It is absurd. Materialism is absurd, I mean, you think. Atheistic materialism is absurd. Yet you've got people running around thinking, saying they're the reasonable ones. They're the free thinkers. Look, there's no reason, and there's no free, and there's no thinking going on if materialism's true. Everything is the product of a previous natural cause. So nobody's free. Nobody's thinking. There's nobody's reasoning. So the ironic thing is the very people who claim they're the beacons of reason have defeated reason by their worldview of materialism. They've made reason impossible. They've made freedom impossible. They've made thinking impossible. Everything is the product of a previous natural cause. So that was an interesting exchange with five atheists after the event, and we've got a few more exchanges. Some of them are pretty funny. You don't want to miss the last segment. You're listening to Cross-Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. Our website, crossexamined.org. Don't forget to get the app. It's free on our website under Media. Just click on Media. You'll see the app there. Works on all platforms. And some of these answers we're talking about here are right there in that app. See you in 2 minutes. Frank Turek back with you. Talking about some questions that I've gotten over the past 2 weeks at campus events, five campus events over the past 2 weeks. Got some coming up as well. Going to be at University of North Carolina at Greensboro on October 5th and, no, it's October 6th and 7th. I'll be at a church October 5th in Greensboro. But October 6th and 7th. So if you're interested in attending, and I don't have enough faith to be an atheist event, check our website out because we'll be in Greensboro October 6th and 7th. Now, I got a question from a 15-year-old kid actually at the University of Southern Illinois, and he said, "Do pets go to heaven?" And I said, "Yes, except cats. They're clearly demonic." And then a whole bunch of people said, "No, we love cats." I said, "Don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. I love cats. They taste like chicken." No, I'm just kidding, friends. I'm just kidding. But it was a moment of levity. We had some fun with that. And of course, the Bible doesn't really say whether or not. It does say the lamb lies down with the lion and all this. That could be a metaphor, obviously, for the fact that there's no more pain or no more suffering. Yes, I understand. I don't see any reason why pets wouldn't be in heaven. Of course, the Bible doesn't address this directly, but why not? You know, why not? Then at Wright State University, I got a question from a very thoughtful atheist agnostic by the name of Travis. Nice young man who spent a lot of time with, actually, talking about some questions. And he got up and he said, "Do you believe in evolution?" Now, if someone ever asks you that question, what should your question back be? Remember, it's not your job to refute what anyone says, because he obviously believed in evolution. It's that person's job to support what he or she says. So the first question you ask when somebody says, "Do you believe in whatever, or do you believe in evolution? What do you mean by evolution?" And I said to him, he was having a little trouble defining it. I said, "Well, look, if you mean change over time, I'm with you. If you mean microevolution, adaptation within type, I'm with you. But if you mean the molecules to man philosophical worldview, that is commonly called Darwinism or neo-Darwinism, no, I don't think there's evidence for that." And he said, "Oh, I think that's what I mean by evolution, that last one." I said, "Okay, well, thanks for clarification. What should your next question be? What evidence do you have for that? Or what conclusion, or how did you come to that conclusion? Why do you think macroevolution is true?" And he really didn't have an answer. He just, you know what he said? He said, "Well, 99.5% of scientists believe that." And he said, "Are you comfortable being or going against those 99.5%? I said, "Absolutely. First of all, it's not 99.5%. In fact, there's a very strong minority of atheists now who, very strong minority of scientists who are expressing severe doubts about macroevolution. In fact, one of the atheists who has recently expressed a lot of doubt about it is a gentleman, a philosopher who teaches at New York University. His name is Thomas Nagel. And Thomas Nagel, back in 1997, famously said this. He's an atheist. He said, it's not just that I don't believe in God. He said, I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the world to be that way. And he said, one of the most disturbing things to me is some of the smartest people I know are religious believers. I'm paraphrasing what he said. Then, just a couple of years ago, 3 years or so ago, he wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos. Mind and Cosmos. I'm looking for it on my shelf right now. I know I'd have it here. I probably can't put my finger on it. I got too many books. But in Mind and Cosmos, what he said, the subtitle of the book was something like why the neo-Darwinian view, materialistic neo-Darwinian view of the world is almost certainly false. So here he is expressing doubts in Darwinism. Of course, he was basically charged with blasphemy by his atheistic colleagues for even suggesting that Darwinism could be false. And he's taken a lot of heat for it, but he's pointing out what many scientists are coming to believe now, and that is if we're going to come up with some sort of atheistic explanation for life and new life forms, we need to find another paradigm other than Darwinism because it doesn't work. And last week's show, we had Stephen Meyer on it. We talked about some of the reasons Darwinism is completely implausible. And so I said, look, I don't care if a majority of people disagree with me. You know, at one point, a majority of people thought that the sun went around the earth. Majority of scientists thought so. Does that mean they were right? No. And in fact, he was a big Einstein fan. And so I said to him, he had asked me a question earlier about Einstein, this Travis young man, his name is Travis. I said, well, Travis, in fact, the great scientific revolutions have all come from minority positions. Just look at Einstein himself, who brought forth the theory of general relativity, which basically replaced Newton's view of physics, Newtonian physics. Which is true. I mean, it was a revolution in a scientific outlook. The whole Big Bang cosmology is a revolution. Prior to Big Bang cosmology, started pretty much by Einstein with his theory of general relativity, most scientists thought the universe was eternal. And Big Bang cosmology ended all that. It was a scientific revolution. And you had many scientists clinging to the steady state theory, the eternal universe theory. For years after the evidence had already come in that the universe had a beginning. And that's what's going on with Darwinism right now. And so I said, what evidence do you have for Darwinism, for macroevolution? And he couldn't give me any. He really couldn't. And he said, but I got four biologists here, four professors here who will vouch for it. I said, well, bring them tomorrow night. I'd love to hear from them. We can have an exchange right here in front of these folks here. And the next night he came, and I said, "Where did you bring any of these?" No, none of them were interested. You know, whenever I ask for evidence, I rarely get it when it comes to evolution. What I get is appeals to authority. Now, maybe the appeals to authority are good. Maybe evolution is true and the authorities are right. But I'm not asking just for their conclusion. I'm asking for the evidence that brings them to their conclusion. And when you look at the evidence that brings them to their conclusion, it's either inadequate or it's circular. What do I mean by that? Well, it's inadequate in one sense because they try and say that dog breeding, for example, is an example of microevolution. In fact, Travis said to me, he said, well, there's really no difference between micro and macroevolution. They're the same. You just extrapolate microevolution and you get macroevolution. I said, well, you could extrapolate it, but the problem is when you try and do it, you don't get macroevolution. We try and do that in dog breeding. We can get all different types of dogs using all of our intelligence. And yet when we do that, how far do we get? We stay in the genus of dogs. We can't break the genus of dogs. We can get dogs as large as a Great Dane and as small as, say, a Chihuahua, but we can't get outside of dogs. And here we are using all our intelligence to do it, and we can't make macroevolution work. Why should we expect a non-intelligent process to do it? We shouldn't. And there's, of course, many positive reasons not to believe that macroevolution could occur. One of them, of course, is genetic limits, what I just talked about. We run into genetic limits when we try and manipulate these different creatures. In fact, you know, in fruit fly experiments, biologists have been manipulating fruit flies, embryonic fruit flies, to see if they could manipulate them and to see how far they can maneuver these fruit flies, and maybe we can get them to become something else. Whenever they alter a fruit fly embryo, the fruit fly embryo, whenever they try and divert it, the fruit fly embryo makes heroic efforts to get back on track to become a fruit fly. Why? Because it's programmed to become a fruit fly. There's an external intellect directing that fruit fly to become a fruit fly. It's expressed in DNA. It's a program. And I said to Travis, I said, Travis, what they get is one of three outcomes with these fruit fly embryo experiments. They get a healthy fruit fly, they get a mutant fruit fly, or they get a dead fruit fly. They don't even get a horse fly, much less a horse. Why? Because a fruit fly is programmed to become a fruit fly. You can manipulate the DNA all you want. You're never going to get anything else other than a fruit fly or a mutant fruit fly or a dead fruit fly. That's it. And to say that some kind of natural process could create it just doesn't square with the facts. He says, well, we haven't given enough time yet. I said, Richard Linsky's been given bacteria enough time. He's been manipulating bacteria for something like 30 years, which would be the equivalent of a million years of human evolution. And after manipulating these bacteria after 30 years, intelligently manipulating them, what does he have? He still has bacteria. So there are genetic limits. There's also irreducible complexity, which says that all the parts have to be in working order in the same spot in order for the creature to have any function. So you can't manipulate a creature gradually and still have the thing live and have function. And Michael Behe has really championed that view with his book Darwin's Black Box. And by the way, Michael Behe is going to be one of the speakers at the Apologetics Conference just after our banquet here. Our banquet is October 9th. All the details are on our website, crossexamined.org. David Limbaugh, Jay Warner Wallace will be speaking. David Limbaugh, of course, the brother of Rush Limbaugh. And the Apologetics Conference is the 10th and the 11th of October right here in Charlotte. So you guys really ought to think about attending. Now, there's a bunch of other questions that I'll get to in a future program, but it's quite interesting, the questions that come up. And many of the questions, as I say, are answered in our new app. So make sure you download the app. It's at our website, crossexamine.org. Just click on the quick answer section, and you can get a lot more there. Great being with you, friends. I'll see you next week. I'm Frank Turek. Again, check out the website, crossexamined.org. See you next week. God bless.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.